This is 90.9 WBUR. Good morning, I'm Bob Oakes. Each year, approximately 6 million children suffer from childhood abuse or neglect, and experts believe the number is likely significantly higher because so many cases go unreported. Many of the psychological consequences of childhood maltreatment are well known, but now it's becoming increasingly clear just how damaging these experiences are to the developing brain. This morning, in part three of our continuing series, From the Front Lines of Neuroscience, a series we're calling Brain Matters, WBUR's Iris Adler looks at a key issue in brain development, the biological consequences of early childhood neglect and abuse.
This is a picture of our family the day Peter was adopted, and it was 7 years ago, almost to the date.
Like any new mother, Braille was full of hope and excitement the day she welcomed her new son into her life.
And his dad is standing here with a big smile on his face. Wouldn't you say that?
Yes.
And I'm bending over to kiss the top of Peter's head. I spent most of that day crying.
Peter, now 14 years old, was 7 when he was adopted. He'd been living in foster care after being taken from his biological mother. Around the dining table, Peter's family share stories of their son's early life, when he and his siblings endured years of neglect and abuse, living with their biological mother and her violent boyfriend.
It was physical, emotional, continual.
The boyfriend, by the account of all the kids, was physically pretty aggressive towards them. On some occasions, forced them to eat chili peppers off the floor.
Peter and his parents, who chose not to use their real names, are very close, but the 7 years since the adoption have been challenging.
He was very sweet and affectionate, and then he would just fall apart and start banging his head against the wall or start screaming, and it seemed to be fear.
Getting punched would not be unusual.
What we didn't realize at the time was that I had PTSD. Things were a little chaotic.
Yes, you got very angry sometimes in ways that were just really hard to predict.
Experts have long known that neglect and abuse in early life increase the risk for psychological problems such as depression and anxiety. But now neuroscientists are explaining why, by showing how abuse and neglect wreak havoc on the developing brain, causing physical damage to key brain areas.
So the way we do the EEG is we have these nets of electrodes, and they're sized from little babies up to adults. And when I mentioned changes in technology, this goes on in just a few minutes.
At his lab at Boston Children's Hospital, neuroscientist Charles Nelson studies the effects of early childhood adversity on the brain's circuitry.
If I'm being physically abused, sexually abused, emotionally abused, then those circuits become abnormal. And as a result, the brain doesn't wire the right way.
So what prevents the brain from wiring the right way? And how does childhood maltreatment get biologically embedded in the brain? The thinking goes like this. If a child is abused or chronically neglected, it represents a profound threat to the child's existence. That sets off a biological stress response and a flood of hormones, many of which damage critical parts of the brain. Experts call the unremitting stress of abuse and neglect neurotoxic.
Let's say there's 1,000 neurons that are supposed to wire in a certain way. Well, maybe only half of them wire that way, and the other half wire in an incorrect way. So by altering the wiring diagram, you're going to alter behavior and alter psychological states.
Many animal studies have looked at the damaging effects of early neglect by putting young mice in isolation, for example. But in the year 2000, Dr. Nelson had the opportunity to study a population of neglected children, Romanian orphans raised in harrowing conditions in state orphanages.
As a neuroscientist, of course, the first thing I wanted to know is what effects are these experiences having on brain development?
Using new neuroimaging tools, Dr. Nelson compared the brains of a group of Romanian orphans to those of children raised outside orphanages.
Finally, when the kids were 8 to 10, we did magnetic resonance imaging on them, where we could actually look at detailed anatomy in the brains. And that was the most disconcerting, because we found that the kids in the institutional group had much smaller brains, which probably is why they had less brain activity. The question is, why are they small? We're not sure, but probably it's due to a loss of connections and a loss of cells.
This can translate into problems with attention deficit disorder, anxiety disorders, and attachment issues. Dr. Nelson says there are lessons here for American children.
Not surprisingly, kids who grow up in families where there's a lot of maltreatment and then are placed in bad foster care and then one foster care and another, they look just like our kids in Romania. So when people say to me, well, who cares about these children in institutions in Romania? Because it's a model system for what happens in the United States every day.
And Dr. Nelson says it's why scientists must take the emerging science out of the lab and into clinical practice.
What I want us to think about is, what would you say in the context of our efforts with a parent who comes in and tells you about that development in their interactions with their kid?
At a Mass General Hospital program for children with behavioral challenges called Think Kids, a number of therapists gather for their weekly meeting. Dr. Stuart Ablon, director of the program, says it's important to understand that these are children with brains that are not fully developed. In other words, they don't lack the will to behave, but the skill.
You know what? This kid's doing the best he can with the skills he has to handle what the world's throwing at him. But that runs completely counter to the more common philosophy out there, which is, if a kid's not doing well, it must be because he doesn't want to. And you know what? We've known forever that hasn't been the case. Now we have the science to back it up.
Ablon says these children are not stubborn or unmotivated, but just like kids with learning disabilities, they lack skills because of differences in their brain development.
Except instead of talking about reading and math and writing, we're talking about stuff like problem solving, frustration tolerance, emotion regulation. Those are the skills that these kids lack.
Dr. Ablon says understanding the science completely changes the approach to helping these children. Trying to motivate them with rewards and punishments is not effective. And he says punishments like restraints are likely to backfire and ratchet up the aggression. That was true for Peter, the 14-year-old we met earlier. Peter is getting help at Think Kids now, and he's doing well. But he says the approach he experienced in earlier therapeutic settings often hurt more than it helped. For example, when he felt a meltdown coming on.
Several teachers started rushing at me, so I reflexively ran out of the room. They pinned me down in the hallway. I was sort of being crushed. Being attacked and forcibly shoved to the floor can be extremely painful. I don't understand how anyone could consider that in any way calming.
Dr. Ablon says science is beginning to show that brain change can happen, especially when children are helped to repeatedly practice skills they lack in trusting relationships.
When the child is asked to, for instance, turn off the video game and start doing their homework, and they begin to escalate, if the adult in that moment can be the one to stay calm and empathize with the child, the child's actually going to start to calm down and be open then to hearing the adult perspective about the problem and being invited to problem solve. It's that type of interaction again and again and again that is the dosing needed to facilitate brain change.
But brain change gets harder as time passes, says Dr. Charles Nelson of Children's Hospital. He says it's critical to intervene early, to provide support for parents and caregivers, treatment or family therapy, and if need be, to remove children from abusive homes. When it comes to the brain, Nelson says, it's pay now or pay later.
Interventions done later in life will likely be less successful in rerouting the brain wiring than interventions done earlier in life. And if you have a particularly plastic circuit, then you might be able to overcome early adversity when placed in a better environment, because the brain is still plastic enough to change.
The cost of delaying is huge, not only in human terms, but also financial. A recent CDC study found the total lifetime estimated costs associated with just 1 year of childhood maltreatment is approximately $124 billion.
As recently as 10 years ago, we could shrug our shoulders and say, you know, I feel bad that this child is neglected, but it's not my problem. Now we can't say that anymore. It is our problem. It's everybody's problem.
Dr. Jack Shonkoff, head of Harvard Center on the Developing Child, says we should respond as urgently to the scourge of childhood abuse and neglect as we have to other public health threats.
The science makes it more difficult to walk away. Once you know the science, now you have a moral responsibility to say we can't allow this to go by. That's what the scientific understanding has done.
For 90.9 WBUR, I'm Iris Adler.
For more on the impact of childhood neglect on the brain, and for our complete series, Brain Matters, go to our website, wbur.org.